This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Our topic is an update of immigration law attorneys working for justice by rapid response and legal representation of undocumented immigrants. My guests are immigration attorney Zachary Nightingale, a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Vanderhoot, Brigliano and Nightingale. He's a specialist in immigration and nationality law certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. Valerie Zukin, lead attorney coordinator with the Northern California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice at the Justice and Diversity Center of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Amid Yazdan Panah, attorney coordinator for development of Northern California Rapid Response and Immigrant Defense Network. His office is in Berkeley. And Sarah Izpana. Izadpana, a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association with office in San Francisco. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the California Board of Legal Specialization, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Let me look to you first, Amid, and tell us something about what's going on with the increase in ICE arrests.
So since the start of this administration, attorneys both in the nonprofit sector and the private sector have expressed concerns about the policies of this administration, specifically the targeting and arrests of undocumented immigrants in this country. And the statistics paint a pretty clear picture as to what is actually going on. So the total number of arrests under this administration has increased 25%. But what's more troubling for us is that the total number of arrests for individuals who have no criminal background whatsoever has more than doubled under this administration. And that includes an overall increase of 40% in the first 8 months of this administration, as well as a 30% increase in the number of public arrests that are taking place in our communities.
What does it mean by public arrests? What do you mean? And talk right into the mic.
Yeah, so that's enforcement actions that take place in the general public as opposed to someone being transferred in custody, in a criminal custody or so forth.
I got you. Would you give us the statistic of persons, immigrants who are represented by counsel versus immigrants who are not represented by counsel in terms of the success rate with respect to whether or not they're going to be deported or not?
Yeah, so there's been a number of studies that have been done focused on individuals who are in immigration custody, in detention, and the success rate for their cases when they have access to counsel versus when they don't. So one study found that 83% of individuals who were represented by a nonprofit were able to actually win their deportation cases versus only 11% of those who did not have representation. So you see just how important it is for individuals who are detained to have counsel when they're going through the immigration proceedings. And that's one of the biggest issues that we're facing right now, is ensuring that due process and access to counsel is part of the system, whether that's in an enforcement action, the day after an enforcement action, or preventing someone from being removed without access to either a judge or an independent third party to review exactly what's going on in their case.
Valerie, if you would, what is the best phone number for someone to call at the Diversity Center? Oh, you can't hear it? What is it? Oh, all right. Well, I have it. What I have is 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. I also have, as a network website, Rapid, R-A-P-I-D, Response, R-E-S-P-O-N-S-E, .sfbar.org, rapidresponse.sfbar.org. And would someone tell us, what is someone going to get if they click this on their computer? What are they going to get?
Yes, so for that website specifically, you can find out information about rapid response efforts in Northern California. There's a flyer that actually outlines various hotline numbers that people can call if they find out about an ICE enforcement action in their community. I want to underscore that those hotline numbers are normally reserved for emergency situations, so you shouldn't use those numbers to just ask questions. But there's also the name
of... You can or cannot.
You cannot. You should not.
But I see.
Alternatively, there's some information about those networks, whether it's a website or other contact information that people can use for general inquiries. But those rapid response hotline numbers are specifically for if you have enforcement action in your community and you would like assistance and to report that action and have someone follow up with the individuals and the families that were targeted.
When you talk about community, how large are we talking about? What part of the state of California are these communities in? Is it just a North Bay, the San Francisco Bay Area, or is it beyond our San Francisco Bay Area? Yeah,
so something that's really encouraging that's taking place to sort of respond to these terrible policies that we're seeing is the fact that there are various rapid response efforts that are organically being put together all over Northern California. So here in San Francisco, we have a great rapid response network that has volunteers and attorneys standing by ready to respond. We also have rapid response networks in Santa Clara, in the East Bay, in the Central Valley, Sacramento, and so on and so forth. So there's a number of different networks. Some have funding and sort of a complete robust system. Others are just starting out and are completely volunteer run, which is also really, really encouraging and inspiring to see. And we also are working on a regional network that will support the local networks as well and provide them with resources, assistance, and hopefully also legal support as well.
With respect to Southern California, the four of you know, the first half hour of your legal rights is the statewide version, which is recorded. It is then sent out to a number of stations in California, which will air the half hour next week. Are there any comparable rapid response organizations going on in Southern California?
Yeah, so there's a network in Los Angeles. For now, I know that it's sort of a committee and it has a legal component and organizing component, and it's sort of being run by the nonprofit folks down there. There's also a rapid response network in San Diego as well. Mm-hmm. So it's really encouraging to see a sort of a community self-defense model being developed all across the state. And these folks are also collaborating with each other and sort of sharing resources, sharing strategies, and really pushing not only to provide the legal support for these families, but also to counter the dehumanization that we're seeing against these immigrant communities by this administration and as a policy of this administration.
Are we seeing a number of people who are coming into, at least into California, asking for asylum, and they're having problems or whatever? Valerie, can you speak to that a bit?
Absolutely. So this is a huge problem that we're seeing. In 2015, ICE opened a new detention facility for new to the San Francisco Immigration Court jurisdiction, and that facility is at Mesa Verde. It's in Bakersfield.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's much closer to Los Angeles and San Francisco in geography, all the individuals detained there their cases are before the San Francisco court. So they're detained about 5 hours' drive from most of the attorneys that practice before this court.
And this is the federal court, or what court is it?
This is the immigration court.
The immigration court, which is a federal immigration court.
It's a federal agency.
Yeah,
correct.
Okay.
So because this is the southernmost facility in this region, and it's also the largest facility in this region, it's the facility that has the most individuals that come through the land border seeking asylum.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a great number of individuals that do come to the land borders. They come up to the immigration agents. They don't have documents to come into the country, and they ask for protection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And these individuals are generally processed but with a procedure called expedited removal. So when someone comes to the border without any documents to be here, they only have a right to ask for asylum. If they express a fear, they have a right to an interview to determine whether or not they can get put into court proceedings to ask for asylum. They don't have more general due process rights to immigration court proceedings like somebody who was apprehended on the interior of the country. So these individuals, the majority of these individuals that we encounter through our services at the San Francisco Immigration Court and through our partner organization services at the Mesa Verde Detention Center, are people who have come to the land border seeking asylum. They have gone through an interview process with the asylum office. The asylum office has found the majority of them to have what's called a credible fear of returning to their country of origin, and they've been thus put into a court procedure to request asylum
before the immigration court.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Okay. Correct. And many of these people are monolingual speakers of a language other than English.
Yes.
Many of them have few or no ties at all in the United States. Some of them are linguistically isolated at the detention facility. Some of them only speak languages that none of the attorneys speak.
Yes.
So it can be quite challenging to provide services to these people. One wonderful thing that has developed in our legal community is that Centro Legal de la Raza and Community Legal Services in East Palo Alto started a pro bono project to serve this population. This project was started in 2015. Since I've come on in my coordination role, as of June of this year, I've taken the lead on coordinating this project, which was established and run by our partners for so long and which our partners are still a huge part of. And this project seeks to place these individuals with pro bono counsel and also
Pro bono, for those people who don't know what that is, that means no cost.
Correct. Okay. We try to place them with pro bono attorneys. Because they're asylum seekers who have just arrived to the country, these cases tend to be legally a little bit easier to place with attorneys who may not be as experienced in immigration law or in detained removal defense work. And we set them up with mentors if needed. Some of them are more
experienced. When you say mentors if needed, what does that mean, mentors if needed?
Sure. So that means that, for example, a solo practitioner might have a law office and they've typically only been doing, you know, citizenship applications and green card applications, you know, not court practice.
Yes.
And this attorney may want to help. And we can link up this attorney who does not have the court experience with an experienced attorney who does have the court experience to provide them with the guidance they need to be able to represent this person.
Ah, very interesting. Zach, what are you doing in this area in terms of this immigration problem?
Well, one aspect that I think the example that Valerie just mentioned highlights is the increased use of detention by the government as a deterrent to individuals fighting their case.
So you're in detention, and therefore, it's like your hands are cuffed, and you can't even move at all.
Exactly. The law provides a remedy, such as applying for asylum in the way that Valerie described. These newly arrived individuals are seeking asylum, and they have every incentive to fight their case because they fear for their lives if they're returned to their home country.
Yes.
But under the prior Obama administration, for example, once somebody passed the first screening called credible fear that indicates that the officer recognizes they have a viable case, they might then be released. They might be placed in a location where it's short of a full detention so that they could have a more normal life, have time to obtain counsel and present their case in the normal course of affairs. Whereas today, it's the administration is almost uniformly continuing to detain the individual as they go through the immigration process, and only if they actually win at the end are they then released into the community. Mm-hmm. So it makes it much harder to find the volunteer attorneys, much harder for the person to sustain themselves being detained through the sometimes months that it takes for the process to complete. And similarly, for individuals who are arrested inside the United States, they may have more rights than the individual at the border, they are similarly being detained at a much higher rate when they're fighting their deportation cases than we had seen before. And I think that is primarily, again, as a deterrent, because it weighs on you to be detained essentially in a jail. And these are often people with no criminal records.
Yeah, yeah.
And they call it civil detention. Mm-hmm. But historically in the United States, we have not had civil detention.
Yeah.
If you're not found guilty of a crime or even charged with one, you can't be detained. And now the immigration system is sort of creating a new detention regime where even though your only violation is civil for not having valid papers, you are now detained for months on end as you fight your case.
Under our law, constitutional law, do these people who you've been referring to, do they have any right to due process?
they have the right to due process, but the Supreme Court has said that doesn't necessarily mean they get to be released. And the law has set up a very complicated scheme of who gets released and who doesn't, and who gets to decide that.
Who does get to decide that?
In the first instance, it's the prosecutor, the ICE officer.
I see.
And in the second instance, for some people, it's then the immigration judge. But sometimes it can take a month before you get that hearing with the judge. And the judge might have to decide if you are a danger or a flight risk. And if the judge thinks your case is iffy, he or she might decide, I'm not going to give you the benefit of the doubt because I'm concerned whether you'll come back or not. And ability to pay is not taken into consideration. And so sometimes a bond is set and it's extraordinarily high.
And they can't pay it. And so they're in.
They
can't get out.
Correct.
What kind of bonds are we talking about? Can you give us some figures?
Usually $10,000-$15,000.
Yeah, which these people don't have.
And it's not the kind of a criminal bond where you pay 10% and go on your way.
Oh,
You have to come up with the full amount. Almost always.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. Sarah, would you do this? You are a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. What comments do you have about anything that we've either been talking about or that you would like to let the listeners know about?
Yes. So I just want to comment about the asylum procedure, specifically for individuals who have just entered into the United States. As Zach mentioned, and as Valerie have mentioned, the first procedure that they go through is the credible fear to determine whether or not they would be able to present their case, to go ahead and present their case before an immigration judge. If they are found to have a credible fear and are then placed into proceedings, and should they be lucky enough to pay their bond and be released, oftentimes their next hearing date is set out well beyond the 1 year of their entry into the United States.
What's the 1 year? What's the significance of the 1 year?
The significance of that is for purposes of asylum, an individual seeking asylum typically needs to file their application within 1 year of their entry into the United States.
Into the United States, all right.
There are exceptions to this rule. There are several exceptions, such as, for instance, changed circumstances within the individual's life, changed circumstances in country conditions, and also psychological or emotional conditions that the individual has potentially suffered as a result of their persecution. However, the challenge that we run into at times when we take on new potential clients is that they have passed their 1 year. They have passed their 1 year before their very first hearing.
Oh my.
Or they have gone to their first hearing, and it is perhaps at that point that they're being oriented with the fact that they should have filed their application within the 1 year. So they're
technically they're late.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the immigration attorney at this time has another hurdle to overcome. We have to overcome, and oftentimes we do. Like I said, there are exceptions, and we are able to overcome it. So I don't want to make it appear that it is impossible. It is not. But it's unfortunate because they're not oriented. Within that asylum interview with an asylum officer, at no point are they told you have 1 year to present
really?
Your application.
So the asylum officer has no obligation, no duty to inform this person?
I don't believe so. I think their job is just to determine whether or not this person is credible or there is a credible fear of return. So that's unfortunate.
Wow. Let me let you all know, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney, and I want you to know who my guests are. And by the way, we are doing this program live on Wednesday, December 6th. And for those of you who are listening to the live program, I invite you to call in the next few minutes and talk with my guests. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. My guests are all immigration attorneys, Zachary Nightingale. He's a certified specialist in immigration and nationality law by the California Board of Legal Specialization. Valerie Zukin, who is the lead attorney coordinator with the Northern California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice at the Justice and Diversity Center of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Amid Yazdan Pana, Attorney Coordinator for the Development of the Northern California Rapid Response and Immigration, or pardon me, and Immigrant Defense Network. His office is in Berkeley. And Sarah Izadpana, a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association with office in San Francisco. A couple of things I want to repeat to you. Kind of, not necessarily the hotline, but the Justice and Diversity Center number that you might want to jot down if you want to get in touch to see if there is an attorney who might be able to help you or someone close to you is 415, pardon me, 989-1616, 415-989-1616. And the website for getting more information, and actually from what Amid said, this is something that can be used throughout the state of California. Rapid Response, that's one word, rapidresponse.sfbar.org, rapidresponse.sfbar.org. We have a few minutes left before the end of the statewide version of the program, and I'd like to cover additional topics that you haven't even talked upon. Amit, please.
Yeah, so I wanted to go back a little bit to what Zach was saying in regards to using detention as a deterrent. Something else that's, I think,
as using detention as a deterrent, that if you're detained, it's much more difficult for you to get counsel.
Yeah, and
is that basically what you're saying?
To pursue your case, to succeed in your case, yeah. And also theoretically to deter folks from crossing the border and coming to ask for asylum.
Okay.
Apart from
that,
I think it's really important to actually underscore the fact that the United States actually detains more immigrants than any country in the world. That's number one. Number two, that the majority of these immigrants are being housed in for-profit detention facilities.
Ah.
And actually, when this last election took place, when Trump won his election, private prison stocks actually rose 100% that day. This is all documented. You can readily access this information. So you have these individuals between 400,000 to 500,000 individuals being held in these for-profit detention facilities, some of whom are making...
Throughout the country?
Throughout the country. And some of whom are working full-time all day at these facilities and making as little as $3 a day. So, on one side of things, there's a deterrent factor, so to speak, but there's actually a profit incentive and a profit motive, exploiting these individuals and this system, I would say maliciously. And it's something that we should actually reflect on as a society, how we're essentially taking it, the most vulnerable individuals, people who are fleeing persecution, men, women, and children who are essentially escaping threats against their lives, and placing them in these for-profit detention facilities to work for $3 a day. That's one side of things. I would also just say that if you read the news these days and certain outlets, for example, Fox News, you can actually see sort of the systematic dehumanization of immigrants. We live in a very unequal time in this country, especially economically. And what they've essentially done is taken people's economic insecurities and redirected it towards this xenophobic narrative, and essentially claiming that these people crossing the border are the reason why wages are going down for unskilled labor. I don't want to go off topic, but you can do an economic analysis and actually see how other factors have actually contributed to that, including changes in industry and production and so forth that are responsible for the concentration of wealth that we see in this country and that has alienated a lot of people in this country. But instead, we have individuals who are looking towards and blaming immigrants for these economic issues, this economic inequality that we see. And then you have xenophobic and racist support for these policies. And you have various folks basically cheerleading the dehumanization of immigrants and the detention and denial of immigrants. And a lot of policies towards immigrants are being misconstrued. Zach mentioned some folks being basically let out of detention after a certain point under the Obama administration. And you have right-wing pundits and others basically claiming that those people were off the hook and free to sort of do whatever they wanted and so on and so forth. That's absolutely not the case. Mm-hmm. It's really important for us to understand what these processes look like. Even if you're not an attorney, you should understand exactly what's going on in our society, whether it's the for-profit detention of immigrants or the egregious examples of racial profiling that are leading to arrests of individuals who are undocumented in our country.
Yes, exactly. And if I could follow up, I think your listeners may be interested to know that there is currently pending a lawsuit in the federal court in the state of Washington, very creative lawsuit brought on behalf of detainees in the private prison system under the legal theory that they are paid for the, quote, work they do that they're required to do when they're detained, far lower than the minimum wage required under the Washington state law. And needless to say, the private prison system defendants are worried about their bottom line if that lawsuit would be successful, and they moved to dismiss it, and the judge refused to dismiss the lawsuit, obviously finding at least potentially some merit to the claims.
Who is representing these the people in this lawsuit?
They are very competent private attorneys.
Are they?
Who see an injustice and are well aware of the inequities created by this private prison system, right, and the deterrent effect and how people are exploited when they are detained in the private prison system.
Who has set the $3 an hour amount? Who has set that? Do we know?
I think the people making the profit, I think.
The people making the profit. Hey.
Exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
My. Hey, let's make more profit. Oh, brother.
Right. So it would be interesting to follow and see what happens with that lawsuit eventually.
We have about 45 seconds left in the statewide version of the program. Does anyone have a further comment that you want to make to the listeners before we end the half hour? And I then invite the listeners to call in and ask questions. I mean, please.
I think history has shown what happens when you, you know, systematically disenfranchise and dehumanize specific minority groups, and it's very disturbing what it could lead to. And I think that whether it's people being detained for profit or individuals not having access to counsel, there's a lot of things that we can do as a society. We live in the richest country in the world. There's no reason why we can't accommodate these requests for people.
All right, everybody, let me give you the toll-free number. If you have questions, if you are facing this immigrant problem, deportation, or if you have someone close to you who's in detention and you would like to call in, ask a question, make a comment, please do so. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Again, the magic phone number, and I don't mean that jokingly, for those of you in certainly who are listening to this program, for the Justice and Diversity Center of the Bar Association of San Francisco regarding the immigrant problem that we have and their rights, it's 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. And the network, if you want to go to the website, is rapidresponse.sfbar.org. Now, let me just give you something else before we take our first call. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you are in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. That number is 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. The reason I tell you this is that this is a very fine public service that the lawyer referral services throughout the state of California are performing. Most counties have bar associations and lawyer referral services. You can call your own in your county, tell them what your problem is, the legal problem. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced in that area and set you up for a half an hour consultation. With minor exception, you will pay $25 to $35 for the half an hour consultation with an attorney. That money does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to keep this very fine public service ongoing. So join us, if you would, with your calls. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Additional funding for your legal rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. As I have said, I have some very experienced attorneys here, immigration attorneys here, and I would hope that you would join us with your questions, your comments. And they are Valerie Zukin, Lead Attorney Coordinator with the Northern California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice at the Justice and Diversity Center of the Bar Association San Francisco. Amid Yazdan Panah, Attorney Coordinator for the Development of the Northern California Rapid Response and Immigrant Defense Network. His office is in Berkeley. Sarah Izad Panah, a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association with office in San Francisco. And Zachary Nightingale, a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Vanderhoot Brigagliano. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Brigagliano.
Brigagliano. Thank you very much. And Nightingale, he's a specialist in immigration and nationality law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. So let's start with Joseph. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Regarding the situation with private prisons that are for profit, I just had a curious kind of question, kind of comment. If I'm not mistaken, and I know I'm on the radio, so I hope I'm not, but in the Constitution, it states that slavery is to be abolished except under the act of incarceration. Now, I'm no fan of anybody trying to repeal anything our forefathers put down, but, you know, regarding the fact that, you know, slavery, I'm sure that we can all agree, has been given a loophole to put illegal immigrants in a situation where they're for profit. I imagine American citizens would love to see a way to have that redacted in some way. Do you have any thoughts on that at all, on trying
very
to
good point,
put
Joseph.
Them together to, you know, hit the ground running?
Thank you very much for that point. That's really a very excellent comment. Zach, do you have some comments to respond to Joseph, please?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that I feel confident that the writers of the 13th Amendment, who put the provision that Joseph just referred to, weren't contemplating civil detention.
Yeah.
Right? So you can't say you have an overdue library book and
so
therefore you're
detention.
A slave. Right.
Yeah.
Like slavery is permitted for you. And similarly in immigration, it's a civil violation. Your paperwork's not in order, but that doesn't mean that you lose all your civil rights and your constitutional rights mm-hmm. that you have by virtue of being a human being in the United States. Mm-hmm. And one of those rights is to be free of unjustified punishment, mm-hmm. right? And free of abuses. And it doesn't mean that you're exempted from all the other laws that should mm-hmm. normally apply. Mm-hmm. Now, what your exact due process rights are is a very complicated, you know, scalpel carving by mm-hmm. the Supreme Court yeah. that gets reviewed periodically. And there is a Supreme Court case pending right now that will determine how long someone could be detained in the immigration system without bail until it's too long and they have to be considered for bail.
When is that set for argument? Do you know that case?
Actually, it's been argued twice.
Oh, it has.
It was held over from last term. On a 4-4 split, presumably, and they couldn't decide. And now they have the full complement of 9 justices. They
yeah.
reheard the argument last month, and we're awaiting a decision.
And that's with Neil Gorsuch coming on the bench.
So it was not really clear from the argument which way the judges are leaning.
Really?
So in the Ninth Circuit right now, after 6 months, you get a bond hearing, but we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to say about that. So which is just to say that when an individual is detained in this sort of unprecedented civil detention, it's not fully developed what rights yeah. you have, yeah. but certainly you have to have the right to not be a slave. I think that probably all sides can agree on that.
Joseph, thank you very much for your comment. Do you have any further response?
Well, no, I appreciate what the gentleman had to say. But I got to say, Chuck Finney, first time ever hearing you, you sound so much like Jeffrey Tambor. It's crazy. I thought you were Jeffrey Tambor, actually, the actor. I just got to tell you, I'm sorry. I don't say it, I'll never get to say it.
Okay,
but thank
all right.
You. I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. All right, everybody. Don't be bashful out there. This is a very, very significant problem in our country. And hopefully it will be improved at some point. But as certainly as Zach has said, we have a kind of a teeter-totter that's teetering-tottering all the time, and we don't have a definity, or it's not definite of what our rights or those who are immigrants and who are in detention and having to work at $3 an hour, whether or not that's considered a due process violation. Certainly, from what I understand, and I am not a constitutional lawyer, I think it is. I think it's a violation of due process to have these people who are detained and then they have to work and they get $3 an hour, which is certainly not permitted, as far as I know, in any state in the United States. That is not something that is supported by the law. So for those of you who might have questions, for those of you who might have close friends or loved ones who might be facing deportation or may have been arrested on this, please call. It's 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And I want to ask those of you who are with me in the studio here, does being arrested automatically mean or equal deportation, Amid, please?
Oftentimes it does not, mm-hmm. but it's a very, very important moment in that individual's case status. And so some individuals who have either a prior deportation or a very serious crime, they may be subject to an expedited removal process, whereas others may actually have the ability to ask for an interview to express fear and be issued a date to appear in court, and they may be also eligible for bond and other releases. So it's really important, and that's part of the focus of Rapid Response, is to provide these individuals access to counsel, provide them a consultation, just so they understand what their rights are. I think the biggest challenge for a lot of individuals is to just understand what their next steps are, and there's so much fear in these communities that people oftentimes avoid actually going to an attorney the way they avoid going to the dentist or the doctor.
Tell us, why are they afraid to go to an attorney?
Well, I think for these populations, they've been systematically exploited oftentimes.
They've
been taken advantage of by various individuals, and reluctant.
Big shotgun shy, obviously.
And they're also reluctant to hear bad news and to just understand what the reality of their situation is, because there's so much fear and anxiety surrounding it, so that they don't do these things until it's too late.
Well, under our system now, if someone is arrested and is in detention, does that person have a right under our law to be able to call to see if he or she can obtain counsel? I mean, this is something that I think under due process, excluding for a moment the immigration issue, is part of what due process permits someone who has been arrested and detained. Valerie, if you would.
The immigration law does provide the right to counsel of the immigrant's choosing. However, it is at no cost to the government. So what that means is people can pay for attorneys or they can look for free attorneys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The reality is many of the individuals in immigration detention are unable to afford a private attorney. Even if they have some funds for a private attorney, it's particularly difficult when they are detained very geographically far from the San Francisco Immigration Court, which makes a case more costly for many of the private attorneys to take. And there are not enough pro bono and nonprofit attorneys to take the many hundreds of individuals at any given time that need representation. So unfortunately, we are in a situation where we are very far from universal representation, and the majority of individuals, unfortunately, have to proceed without counsel. We are doing everything that we can to change that. This year, we've seen a huge increase in funding for pro bono and nonprofit representation, and which is wonderful, but we are still very far from having
attorneys. Where is that funding coming from, basically?
So right now, there is a variety of funding, some from private foundations, some from local governments and cities and counties like San Francisco, Santa Clara, San Mateo, Alameda. I'm sure I'm missing some.
Mm-hmm.
Also from, now there is state funding to that from California that has been already granted to several organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the funding sources have significant limitations. For example, the state funding has carve-outs for certain criminal convictions. It also doesn't cover certain individuals arrested at the border versus in the interior. Mm-hmm. The sort of the language of the law just limits it, mm-hmm. and does not include certain classes of people that are in detention. So we're very lucky that we also have some private foundation funding that doesn't have any restrictions, and so we try to use all of it together,
mm-hmm.
to help people. But we are very far from meeting the need.
If someone is listening to the first half hour of the program, which we just left and will be aired on a number of stations throughout California next week, if they're listening to the program and let's say they're in Southern California and they want to find out where's the rapid response in my area, can they go to, for example, the website rapidresponse.sfbar.org? Ahmed, you're shaking your head the wrong way.
Yeah, so that specific URL is for the Northern California Rapid,
okay.
Response Networks. There isn't as much information about Southern California on there. But if folks Google things like LA Rapid Response or reach out to some of the nonprofits down there, I'm sure they'll be able to find out exactly how to get in touch with
those
folks.
So there is some hope. There
yes.
is some hope, but you got to do some groundwork to find it, and I hope you will if you or someone close to you is faced with this problem. Oliver, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Thank you for being there for all of us. I was wondering if it's okay for me to make a comment that is somewhat related but is not on the subject.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So I would, since you have all these fine lawyers there, I would like to put this out to them. I have been listening to a lot of old podcasts on Breitbart, and specifically Mr. Bannon's, where he interviewed a lot of congressmen and senators, U.S., and they apparently have, if you go back and listen, there they have in their mind the target, the 14th Amendment, to somehow, if they can have enough majority, supermajority in enough state houses throughout, like, you know, House of Representatives, state legislatures, that they can bring about change to and affect the 14th Amendment and somehow change the demographic of America. This, I would like to ask, is there anything in the 14th Amendment by changing that that would actually could affect that? That's what my real question is.
To affect Oliver, in what way do you understand it would affect that? What do you believe?
Well, they from what I understand, is over, like, listening to a lot of these different, you know, they keep coming and revisiting the 14th Amendment. Is that, again, I'm a layman, I don't understand it very well. There's six parts to the 14th Amendment. One of them is equal protection under the law. The other one is you cannot strip someone of their citizenship. Another one is like the subordination of all states' laws to federal law and all state constitutions to federal constitution. I could be wrong about this. And by somehow tweaking this, you could change the law so that they can strip people of citizenship.
I got
and
you.
Also,
I
and, and also the and also not and also not give people equal protection under the law.
All right.
I could be wrong about it, but I'll take if you want, I can take it to stay online, or I could just listen to you offline.
Put your radio back up, would you, Oliver? Let me see if I can get some comments for you. And thank you very much for calling in. Zach, if you would, please.
So I have not heard those broadcasts that you mentioned, but probably it's a reference to the fact that the 14th Amendment does say anybody born in the United States, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, is a citizen of the United States at birth.
Yeah.
And the anti-immigration advocates feel offended by the fact that even if the parents or mother or father don't have legal status, that's a very complicated term, but to simplify it, when the baby is born
In the United States.
Correct. When the baby is born in the United States, the baby is a U.S. citizen.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This goes again back to the Civil War period to make clear that anyone who was born here is a citizen here.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that at the time included slaves who were newly freed, and the principle that if you're born in the United States, you are a United States citizen. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because historically many countries only made you a citizen if you had a blood connection, right? If your parents were actually citizens.
Citizens to begin with. All right.
Which means you have many countries where you could have second or third generation born individuals who are not citizens of the country they're
yeah.
born in and otherwise have no citizenship. Yeah. And the United States doesn't want that to happen. The United States wants people to have a place that they belong. And so if you're born there, you belong to that country and you're a citizen of that country. That's how the United States has looked at it for since the Civil War, basically. And that's ingrained. So if the anti-immigration individuals want to find a way to repeal that principle, right, it's pretty much as anti-American as it gets.
Yeah.
And they are probably motivated by a belief, a nationalistic, nativist, and racist belief, right, that the individuals who are born to non-citizens don't deserve that same citizenship, probably because they don't look European.
You don't see this with our Supreme Court ever going along with changing equal protection as we now have it, do you?
I don't see the Supreme Court doing that, but here's what I believe is the agenda of the anti-immigrant right, and that is to take control of the state houses.
I see.
And through the state houses, if you have a supermajority of the state houses, you can enact a constitutional amendment, which would be a way to change this principle of that 14th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not unrealistic given the direction things are going right now.
Yeah, that's very scary. I think it's very scary for all of us in this country. Go ahead, Amit.
I also just have just a general observation. I just find it very interesting that we live in a time where an individual who is a billionaire is holding the highest office in the land, and he's basically saying that the problems that we're facing in our country and the issues that you are frustrated with, a regular Joe working 9 to 5 trying to make ends meet, it is because of an immigrant who's essentially probably making less money than you are. It's not the record profits that we're seeing in the private industry for certain corporations. It's not the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few people who are still, by the way, making those profits hand over fist, including the person sitting in the Oval Office right now. It's not from them, but it's these people of color who are essentially working jobs that most Americans don't want.
Yeah.
I find it rather ironic that that's sort of the narrative that people are accepting and sort of legitimizing in many ways.
Let me give you again the Justice and Diversity Center phone number in case you might be looking for some help with regard to the immigration issue. It's 415-989-1616. And then the website, if you would like to do that, and this is for Northern California, rapidresponse.sfbar.org. I do want to have those of you who still have questions or comments and would like to pose them to my guests here to please call. We have a few minutes left in the program. Please, if you do want to call and ask a question or make a comment, do it now. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We did the first segment of this where we were talking about rapid response back in August and legal representation of undocumented immigrants. We did this back in August, and it was felt that we probably should do another program before the end of the year. And, of course, what I have learned, and if you've been keeping up with what's going on with the ICE arrests, things have gotten worse. And so I hope that those of you who may be confronted with this, or close friends or family members, will take advantage of at least trying to help yourselves with the website that we've given you, the phone number. And then Amid said, Google, if you're in Southern California, Google a rapid response there, or a private, or not private, but nonprofit organizations that may be able to help you, because this is what you got to do. You just can't give up. Don't give up.
Yeah, and if you can, try and join a rapid response network yourself. If you have status in this country, it's a great opportunity to get involved in something, get involved in your community, advocate for people who don't have the voice to advocate for themselves, and be a part of something that will actually lead to due process.
Very good. Very good point. So the individuals, if they are not detained and feel so encouraged to do so, can become involved with rapid response.
Yeah, a lot of these networks are actually completely volunteer run. They're started by local community members dedicating their time, energy, and resources. Mm-hmm. It's really actually inspiring and encouraging. And I find that oftentimes when you encounter dehumanization and these terrible policies is when you actually affirm your own humanity and the humanity of those around you.
Yeah. Very good. I think Martin has another listener who wants to talk with us. I hope we do. Again, I just want to thank my guests here and give their titles before we end the program. Sarah Izzad Panah is a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Her office is in San Francisco. Amid Yazdan Panah is the Attorney Coordinator for Development of the Northern California Rapid Response and Immigrant Defense Network. His office is in Berkeley. Valerie Zukin is the Lead Attorney Coordinator with the Northern California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice at the Justice and Diversity Center of the Bar Association of San Francisco. And Zachary Nightingale is a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Vanderhoot, Briagliano. Did I do it right? Briagliano and Nightingale. He's a specialist in immigration and nationality law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. I guess I saw the light on the phone, and that person disappeared. So we have about another 4 minutes or so of the program. What, Valerie, what final comments would you like to make at this point?
I would just like to point out that even though we're facing a lot of scary figures and scary numbers, and the detention numbers seem to be increasing, and the percentage of folks without criminal convictions who are being detained for civil detention for immigration cases is increasing. We are very fortunate to have all of this, these increased funding efforts that have come through this year. And even just as we are starting to tabulate figures and statistics, just with the three attorneys that are doing direct representation with the private funding that also funds my position, we are already seeing to mirror these statistics that have already been shown in past reports, we're already seeing that folks that are represented by our nonprofit attorneys are successful about 40% of the time in getting released from detention, whereas the regular average for unrepresented immigrants is only
11%. I'm sorry, non-represented is what?
11%. So, and this is, I think our statistics will be much more accurate and robust with time, but, we're already seeing a great impact from the increased representation.
Incredible. I mean, let me come back to you for a moment. You mentioned in the United States there's something like, I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact number, you said between 400 and 500,000 people in detention, immigrant detention. How many of those, what percentage of those do you know are people who have come asking for asylum? Do you have any idea?
I don't have those numbers readily available to me.
All right. All right. What are the comments in the remaining? We have about, I would say, about 3 minutes left of the program. We're getting to the point that I want to have. Sarah, you want to say something? Please?
Yes, I do. I want to reiterate that the availability of pro bono assistance in court, in the San Francisco Immigration Court, whether it be the Detained Immigration Court or the Non-Detained Immigration Court, through the Bar Association, I believe it's the Justice and Diversity Center, mm-hmm. They do make attorneys available in court to give advice for the day for any individual that is not represented. Mm-hmm. I also want to reiterate that while it is of utmost importance to get help from an individual, we have to keep in mind that the individual with whom clients speak to are licensed attorneys and not notaries. I know mm-hmm. this is something that we touched on.
That's something we've got to be real careful about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I know we touched on this back in August. Yes, but yes. Again, I think it's really important to underscore that notaries in Mexico, Central America, and many countries are also legal representatives and have the right to represent individuals. In the United States, notaries do not have a right to appear in immigration court. They are not lawyers. They do not know the law. Therefore, if an individual seeks help from a notary, they're actually putting themselves at a massive disadvantage.
Yeah.
And so individuals have to be very aware and very careful of whom they are seeking help from.
If someone is solicited by someone who represents him or herself as a notary, I'll help you with your immigration situation. For that person to try to help him or herself, is there some place they can call to say, is this person a lawyer or whatever?
Yes, absolutely. Well, the first thing you can do is ask that individual to see their license, because given that immigration is federal law, you mm-hmm. don't have to necessarily just be barred in the state of California. You can be barred in any other state. So the first thing I would do is to ask to see that individual's license. And from
license there, as an attorney.
As an attorney. And yes. If they don't have one, that should be a red flag.
Yeah, it should be. A very, very large red flag. Yes. Anything else in a few seconds left? Ahmed, 15 seconds.
Due process will only, unfortunately, in the immigration system, be available if we fight for it, and access to attorneys and access to counsel is essential. So,
I want to thank you very much for joining us. Sarah Izad Panah, Ahmed Yazdan Panah, Valerie Zukin, and Zachary Nightingale, thank you very much for joining us on Your Legal Rights and being such great immigration attorneys. Next time on Your Legal Rights, we'll talk about divorced or divorcing parents of young children working together to make the holidays happy for their young children. Guests will be family law certified specialist B.J. Fatum, child welfare certified specialist Mary Feldman, Santa Clara County Superior Court Family Court Settlement Officer Sharon Ross, and Marriage and Family Therapist Valerie Houghton. Your Legal Rights production staff members are Program Engineer Joanne Marr and Production Assistant Martin McLean. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association San Francisco, and the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program for national distribution. Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights Public Radio, and I hope you join us next time on your public radio station. I'm Chuck Finney.